Welcome to the Better Call Saul edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Jaws 3D to my white heat. It's Dan.
Good evening for a few minutes, Scott.
Yeah, we finally started one of these recordings before midnight, although we don't have many minutes to go there. And speaking of surprises, like actually us recording before midnight, I guess we do have another one for our listeners. And what would that be, Dan?
Oh, well, we have Brian on the podcast. And normally I would thank him for joining us, but after he basically booted me off the podcast and is only allowing me to be on his own will, I guess I should be thanking him for letting me be on the podcast. So, hi, Brian. Hi, Master.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good.
I like that you both sound so far away.
Well, I have to continually keep moving because I'm afraid if Dan finds my position, I will be eliminated. So I'm continually moving.
All right. Yes, we should mention that Brian is. I don't know if it's the first time it's happened on one of our podcasts. I feel like it's happened before, but Brian is in the middle of driving. Across state lines and stuff. So if at any point during this podcast you're wondering why it sounds like there's a bit of wind rushing through here, it's because he's actually cruising down the highway. So it's a natural sound. So no one's farting or anything like that on the podcast.
Yeah, and the good thing is that since he's a hardworking lawyer who works many hours, that there's always a chance there'll be a live reenactment of the Kim Wexler car crash on the pod. So if you hear any really obnoxious noises and papers fluttering around, it's probably that.
that's a really great sentiment, Dan. I appreciate that.
That's an amazing pep talk.
Anywho, so once again, we are here to be talking about our favorite little lawyer-based show, and we know that therefore it's also partial to Brian's heart as well, being a lawyer himself. So, without any further ado, let's get started talking about the latest episode of Better Call Saul. Now, the latest episode, I do believe, was titled Breathe, and for a change, I did check out who wrote and directed this one. It was written by old Tommy Schnauz. I never know how to pronounce his name. Either way, it's funny to me. But he's a longtime Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, writer, producer. Another one of those guys who came with Vince Gilligan from the X-Files and stuff, as Dan well knows. And directed, I believe it was directed by Michelle McLaren, who's also a veteran of both Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. So, it's basically the same kind of crew who writes Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, once again. Which is appropriate, because when we start with some characters that we know from Breaking Bad. We start with the fact that Gus brings in old Dr. Barry Goodman, who we did see, I think, briefly last season as well, but I think we remember more from his time on Breaking Bad as the special surgeon that helped out Gus and such in the middle of the desert there. But they had him checking on Hector in the middle of the night while Victor was watching the door. And there was that really nice little bit after that where Dr. Goodman and Gus are talking in a car, and there's no love lost for Hector from Dr. Goodman. He says pretty much, why do they care? He's pretty much got what he deserves. And I believe Gus has a line like, I decide what he deserves, what he deserves to get, no one else, or something like that. So it was a nice little update on Hector. Do you guys have any thoughts on that moment? Let's Brian, what'd you think first?
I thought seeing the old character was a good callback. They used the zoom in on the eye, which I think, I guess, every episode was someone is required to have now, apparently. But I liked it. His breathing is labored, and since it was called Breathe, I tried to look at all the moments that sort of was called out.
Mm-hmm.
So, he breathes very audibly, and so you know he's alive, but he's struggling just after the stroke. But I enjoyed it and enjoyed the scenes. You know, there are some other scenes I'm sure we'll talk about soon in the hospital that I thought were really great.
Right.
But seeing there, you know, this episode had a number of characters brought back, with the Doctor being the first, and then, you know, later we see Joan Cusack again. So I thought it was nice. It was nice to see those characters integrated, and also Lydia, was in this one. So I enjoyed it.
Did you say Joan Cusack?
I think I got her name wrong. Did I get her name wrong? Is it Ann Cusack?
Yes. Okay. Let's see. Wait, Joan Cusack was on the show. How did I miss that? I love Joan Cusack. There are several Breaking Bad people who were sprinkled throughout this episode. Of course, some of these folks are now going to be on this show for a while now, so that we can actually just consider them Better Call Saul characters after a couple episodes.
Right.
And going with what you were saying about the title Breathe, it's probably not a coincidence then that you begin the episode with the labored breathing of old man Hector in his hospital bed, and the show effectively ends with someone laboring to breathe until they have their last breath. So it's kind of the show is kind of bookended that way, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, you could have called it Box Cutter. It was sort of like the prequel to Box Cutter.
Right. Which is nice to say, since, you know, the guy who was killed in Box Cutter, you know, plays a part throughout this episode as well.
Right.
Dan, was there anything that caught your eye or ear about the stuff as well?
No, you guys covered the hospital, early hospital scene pretty well.
Yeah, it's really... Yeah.
Nice to see the Doctor again. I like when they, you know, take characters we've seen in the future and past and bring them back like this. This makes the whole thing feel a lot more, you know, like a cohesive story.
Right. The universe still, you know, still coming together and building at the same time. And, you know, it's a relatively short first act. Whereas Act 2 is interesting because it's one of those rare acts where they kind of bounce back and forth between a number of different storylines. We start out with Jimmy in the morning making breakfast, and apparently he's going to go on this major job hunt, and just before he's about to leave, that's when Kim drops that line about going to that meeting, and he's like, "No, you know, I'm sure Howard will let me know." So we know that there's something going on, probably involving, and I guess it was fair to guess that it was going to be something involving Chuck's estate or something. So I assumed that right when he mentioned Howard's name. So therefore, I knew there was going to be some scene at some point later in this episode where we were just going to hear how Jimmy got screwed by his brother one last time or something like that. That's what I was thinking at that point, at least.
Yeah, I was interested. We talked last, or you talked last week. Sorry, Dan, I was presumptuous. But you guys talked last week about wondering, would there be more Gene? And the very first thing I looked at was, hey, there's no Gene this episode. And I think maybe the show will stick to the bookends of Gene. We'll see. But I was curious to see what would happen, and there was the only one lawyer moment with Kim and Jimmy. And Jimmy, you know, the first scene in this episode has totally shaken off Chuck and seems, you know, really going at it, and to the point Kim seems a little concerned about him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that kind of carries off the way the previous episode ended, which when Dan and I were talking about it last week, I think we both agreed that was probably the most significant thing in that entire first episode were those last few minutes and what Jimmy says to Howard and then the way he acts from that point on. And I think I felt, and it felt like this is kind of a carryover from that, which I enjoyed for the consistency of it.
Yeah, he was even more so, and especially, you know, like it was morning. He was like up out of bed, ready to go, making breakfast, and that was interesting to see.
Yeah, there's a certain at times Jimmy has this quality, and it's also I would have attributed to it as being a Saul Goodman quality back when if we were watching this on when he was on Breaking Bad, that certain pleasant, almost hyperactivity. Where he's kind of like, you know, he's just bouncing about and he's got a million things going on in his head and the way he's talking, he's fast talking about things. Dan, did you notice that little moment? There's one little moment I wanted to mention in that scene that I thought was, I liked. And I'm betting you noticed it. When Kim first comes out while Jimmy's making the orange juice with her and getting the coffee and all the other stuff, and you notice that she looks over a little longer than one normally would at that thermos. Did you notice that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that her thermos? Was that the thermos that she used to always carry around?
I'm not sure. I got the impression that maybe she was like wondering why he was using a thermos other than the one that she got him.
Well, I remember there was that episode, I think, that he'd gotten a thermos and he couldn't fit it in the thing in the car. And he had that whole issue from way back when. But I felt it was... See, I was trying to figure out if that was something referring to the fact that she's not out and active and being her lawyerly self, or if it was something more about Jimmy. I couldn't make up my mind in that moment. I was thinking it was more about her, but the way you're talking, maybe it's more about her thinking about him. So that might make sense.
But she definitely gave it a weird look, so it might need some more investigation.
Right, and so then all of a sudden we go from that to a scene with Nacho and his dad. It was one of those scenes I was waiting for this, since I think even in one of the ads for the season they showed a scene from last season of Hector counting out the money that he gives to that he forces Nacho's dad to take. So I was waiting for like his dad to take the money out with, you know, like, he hasn't even touched the money or something like that. So that kind of went the way I thought it was going to. I think what that serves to do, if nothing else, it serves to ground Nacho and his storyline. There's a certain tragic or sad nature to him that most of the other antagonistic style characters don't possess. So it makes us care just a little bit more about him than we normally would for any of these right-hand men. Like I don't think we care about Victor or Tyrus, but we care about Nacho because we've got much more backstory on him.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like watching this episode and the way the arc went for Nacho, that maybe Michael Mando, who is fantastic, has always been fantastic, that he's really going to be the recipient of being most filled out by Better Call Saul. And he was great in Breaking Bad, and we all loved him. But I think the way they filled his character out has maybe been between he and Kim Wexler, those two characters really fill out this cast. And his story going back and revisiting him, particularly showing all this in the episode, I thought he's a big winner in the actor and the character, I think.
Right. I don't think Nacho's actually on Breaking Bad, though. Nacho was introduced on this show. He wasn't on Breaking Bad.
Not at all?
No.
No.
Have I lost my mind? I must have highway brain.
I think what you might be just letting the first season of Better Call Saul kind of bleed into your brain and becoming like as though it was just, you know, an addendum to Breaking Bad or something. Because the whole thing with Breaking Bad is, and the very first Saul Goodman appearance, when Jesse and Walt, you know, take him prisoner in that moment with the silly ski masks and everything. At first, he says the name Ignacio, however you pronounce it. Yeah, there you go, mispronouncing words once again. And so they've kind of had fun with the idea of making it that Nacho's actual name is Ignacio, so that he must have been referring to that character. But that's as close as you get to him having anything to do with Breaking Bad. So, however, the fact that Saul Goodman says that on Breaking Bad kind of hints at that maybe Nacho isn't going to get killed off on the show. So it's kind of, at least it's one interesting thing about it, I guess.
Well, I will withdraw my point, but restate that Michael Mando, I like the guy. I really like the way he plays that character, and I really like the way they're using that character.
Right. Well, I'm gonna have a silly question that just occurred to me that I'll wait for the I'll wait towards the end of the podcast to ask about the overall episode and between two different characters, and he will be one of them. So something to stay tuned for. It's gonna be really stupid, so don't bother stay tuned. Anyway, then we get this really wonderful and kind of really want to think about it kind of a scene with Jimmy. He goes on that interview to be like a copier salesman. And he basically goes into the full salesman pitch for himself. To the point where he even leaves and comes back and then goes he goes for the hard sell. And he sells them on hiring him. And then he reverses. Because how could they possibly hire someone without doing, you know, a background check, a due diligence? He thinks they're suckers and just walks out. Dan, what did you think about that scene? Because that was one of the ones that made me kind of like scratch my head, just think about it for a few minutes before I unpaused the show. I wanted to hear what your take on it was.
Yeah, well, you know, the way it ended, it's difficult to say if like he's just like self-sabotaging because he's just screwed up over like what happened with Chuck. Just doesn't want a job because he wants an excuse to like, you know, do some skeevy stuff and like be the bad boy that like, you know, that Chuck said that he was, just, you know, out of spite. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that, like, you know, the Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul have always been like, you know, they've liked working in their classic movie references. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, having the thing named after the character Neff from Double Indemnity, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Also, I got the impression that they're kind of modeling the that character too. Just that they had him dressed pretty almost exactly the same as Edward G. Robinson, his character in that movie as well, you know, other than not having like a cool watch type thing. But I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, I was trying to, I mean, obviously, you know, a clear read on it would be, you know, it's a form of self-sabotage, which, it's almost a mini microcosm of Jimmy season to season. How he does something which is impressive, he's on the precipice of success, and then somehow it gets screwed up, and it's usually to some extent, either directly or indirectly, of his own doing. His undoing is his own fault to whatever degree, because he slips into slipping Jimmy mode or whatever. And yeah, you kind of wonder if maybe this just came too easy to him. Or does Jimmy really want to do some just regular, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 or whatever the hours would be kind of a job? I don't, just because he's circling a million things in the wanted doesn't mean that's what he's really looking for. You know, it almost makes me think he's going to go on all these job interviews to look for a place where he can also find the right angle, where he can work into something more to his advantage than just a simple job. And it isn't until later on in the episode, with that brief call to Mike after he's looking online. When I wonder if when he's looking at the all the awards and he focuses on that Hummel figure, which reminds him of the lady with the gigantic collection of Hummel figures from a couple seasons ago. If just that alone kind of sparks his, you know, the slip in Jimmy side, so to speak. Because we can already know that that's going to lead to something like, well, you know, robbing the lady or something equally crappy. Since he already seems to not have a problem screwing around with, you know, screwing over old senior citizens, I guess.
Yeah, I thought my take on that scene was almost like those guys were so easy and so naive. That really, is that the kind of place he would want to work? And he fooled them so simply; there was no challenge to it. Mm-hmm. And also, I thought he talked so much about being from the mailroom and working there that is, if he took another job, would he really want to go back to that?
Right.
He knew it, but you know, in a way, that takes him backwards to a time that maybe he didn't want to go to.
Right. And even if one looks at it from a pure, you know, what's better for you kind of perspective, or a more rational way, that happens to people all the time. You know, it's just like, you know, let's say you worked, speaking from personal experience, say you worked in a specific industry for, you know, a number of years, and you know, after a while, you've got burned out on it, or whatever the situation is. It's, you know, maybe it's a dying industry, maybe there's an issue with whatever. So you're looking for something new, and maybe you get contact, maybe you get offered something that's in that industry. And do you slip back into that role, even though you know it's not going to go anywhere? It's just, it's going to be that same dead end that you were in before. And granted, he wouldn't be in a mailroom anymore, but still, being the guy who sells the copiers, is that really something? Even if he wasn't at the top of his profession, that's a huge drop down from being a lawyer to being the guy selling copiers. So it didn't really shock me too much. It was just the way that everything got compressed in such a short amount of time, which I found fascinating. You know, go on.
It really was, but I liked, you know, the pitch he made about a lawyer sells something. I mean, that's very true. I mean, you're selling a story to a jury, to a judge, even, you know, in a plea negotiation, you're selling a story to a prosecutor. Here's why you should do this. Here's why we should make this deal. And it was nice to see him slip into that role. Because, I mean, he in that scene between the breakfast and that, you know, he sort of thought, hey, he's really getting his mojo back.
Right. Absolutely. Which, I mean, to a certain extent, we kind of want to see that with him. Because, I mean, while the acting quality is top-notch, when Jimmy or Bob Odenkirk as Jimmy is having his sadness and his sullenness and his moodiness, we kind of want to see him more active again, the way he can be. So it's kind of nice to see that change happen, even if it's not for the best of reasons.
Yeah, but it's a double-edged sword because you know where that's going to lead.
Right, but I think that's the thing about watching this show. We kind of all know that's where it's going to lead.
Right.
So then we kind of is there anything else we wanted to cover on that one before we move on to Mike?
No.
Okay. Actually, that's in the next act. So Act 3, we lead off with Mike, and then realize, wow, this is an episode where they're really touching all the bases. We're getting a little bit of every character. No one's getting left out in this one, which is kind of cool. We see Mike, and he's hanging out at that playground with his way older than she should be granddaughter. And this was addressed in an article I read that they decided they didn't care. So it is a rather considerable continuity flaw, but we just kind of ignore it. She's way older than she should be. she's actually older than she is when she's on Breaking Bad. But they just like, yeah, we just like the actress, so we don't care.
I had the exact same thought too. Just like, she's so much bigger here than she was like 5 years from now.
Oh yeah, they just don't care. So Mike goes to see Lydia, who's basically looking for an explanation for his for what he did at the at that magical office, as far as his little security consultant is. There's clearly a difference of opinion between them as far as what they think should or shouldn't be done. And she, it's interesting, at one point she says to him, you know, at the moment you have Gus Fring's respect, I'd want to keep it that way if I were you. But then we see later on, you know, Lydia on the phone with Gus, and Gus has pretty much let him do what he wants, you know, because Gus doesn't really want to be bothered with this. The fact that it annoys Lydia probably means absolutely nothing to Gus, and nor should it.
Yes, especially right now, because Gus is so freaked out about, you know, losing, a Hector kind of being in a shitty state without it actually coming from him. So, definitely not a happy camper the whole episode. So this kind of matter wasn't something he wanted to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you're bothering me about, you know, this, you know, moving, you know, so moving the furniture around when I'm worried about that, worried about this house collapsing. Go away. Brian, was there, so since you mentioned Joan Cusack, I mean Lydia, before, sorry, I couldn't resist, was there anything that you wanted to say about that before we move on to the cousins?
No, I liked the scene, and I liked that she seemed to be maybe more nervous than we see her later, and seemed unsure, but I thought it was effective.
Well, I think I always felt that she tends to be a little bit on the nervous side. And maybe that's because all the people around her are so not. You know, either be Gus Fring or Mike, or even when she was dealing with Walter, you know, on Breaking Bad, you know, they all seem to be very either stoic or just immovable. And she's kind of, you know, The only thing missing from this scene was her, like, you know, shaking a Splenda packet. Or was it Splenda she used to eat? Or no, something, it was a different kind of sugar. Fake sugar, I can't remember. Wasn't Splenda. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, Stevia.
Stevia, thank you. So then we bounce back to the hospital. And we remember earlier, Dr. Barry Goodman had mentioned, you know, he was pretty much getting great care, unless, you know, the only thing that would be better would be someone like from Johns Hopkins. So naturally, someone from a doctor from Johns Hopkins shows up to check on Hector. And this time, the cousins are there. The cousins are standing there watching over Hector. And the doctor conveniently can speak Spanish. So this is a more of a subtitle-y scene with her informing them of his condition and what can be done. At a certain point, Nacho and I forget his name. I guess kept calling him Ponytail Guy. Does anyone remember what that guy's name is? Because I can't remember what his name is. I didn't look it up.
I never could think of it, and I tried to the whole episode.
Yeah. Yeah, well, rest in peace, Ponytail Guy. I think one of my favorite little moments in the scene, because this scene starts to become pretty much almost comical at a certain point, especially when she's telling the cousins that one of the things to do to help Hector is to talk to him, to speak to him as much as possible. And it's like, okay, the two characters who speak the least in the history of Breaking Bad and now this show, they're the ones who need to start talking now. So it's funny watching Ponytail Guy and Nacho kind of awkwardly try to talk to Don Hector. It just the longer it went on, the more uncomfortable it was making me, but in a nice, funny, almost The Office style way, I thought.
The camera work of going back and forth and showing that, you know, everybody's head move,
I mean, it was obviously played to great comedic effect.
Oh yeah. Oh, when like I mean, I swear that the cousins' heads both kind of swivel together at the same time, like they're one creature almost. So
yes, very much, and it's almost like. It's almost like they pass it to Nacho, and then Nacho passes it to Ponytail Guy, and then it goes back to him, and then they look to them. It's like a really weird game of sort of ping pong, you know, a three-way ping pong, you know, to stick with the three-way theme. So,
and it's also funny that they really have no idea of how to. Yeah, I'm gonna let the three-way joke go by. Dad can make it if he wants. It's also funny because they have
let it go by.
they have no idea how to speak to this guy. All you're like, oh, everything's going well. You're still collecting your money. You look good. You're gonna come back stronger than ever. It's really like, because now if Tuco was there, he'd be talking a mile a minute in his ear or whatever. But these guys. So yeah, if someone was going to tell me there was the most comical moment in the episode would involve, you know, the cousins and Nacho and whatever, I'd be like, really? What's going on? Is the rest of the episode a funeral? I don't know. That's kind of strange.
Yeah.
So like, I didn't very much enjoy that.
And it's just so awkward too, because I mean, like, they know that, like, I guess potentially Don Hector can like hear what they're saying, but like none of them have ever had a conversation with them at all, like other than like, you know, five words of him just being a giant prick to them. So I mean, just they're trying to find shit to say. It's just it's comical, but I enjoyed how awkward it was.
It was great, and the interplay of the silence with the words. But I like at the end, you know, when Nacho says you'll come back stronger than ever, it sort of ends not totally comedic. Because, well, you know, he's thinking he's now protected. He may come through it. He's got the best care possible. And if he survives, you know, look what I've done and I'm screwed.
Right. Yeah. You can see it by the look on his face. When he said that one. Which then takes us to Act 4, and that's when Gus does get that call from Lydia that we had mentioned already. But he also gets an update on what's been going on from Tyrus, and I'll admit that I had kind of forgotten what Tyrus's name was. I did have to look that up. Which is a little shameful because he was in so many episodes of Breaking Bad. I should have remembered his freaking name, but I never remembered his name. And then we get to one of my favorite one of my favorite scenes in the episode, personally. This is what Kim goes to the law firm, and again, as I think we all suspected, it was to see about the settling of Chuck's estate. His ex-wife Rebecca is there, Howard. As one would suspect, he pretty much left her the house and pretty much most of his money, whatever. He did leave Jimmy a little bit of money, and I like Kim kind of guessing what it was before, you know, Howard even says how much it is, which is, how much is it, 4,000? It's like 5,000, which apparently, and Brian, I know it's not your area of law, but I guess you, so I don't know if you can attest to this or not, but it's just the right amount where someone wouldn't really be able to contest a will as though they would just get totally shut out of her. She said something along those lines, I think.
Yeah, it's enough consideration that the person really gave somebody something of value, mm-hmm. so that it would help if someone contested a will.
Right.
And in a lot of states, if someone died, even with a will, people can contest if they don't get certain levels of contribution, like a spouse can elect against a will and get 50%
right.
In some states. So. You know, I don't know the laws, but I would assume, based on what, you know, that scene says, is any heir would get something. And that's enough that at least there would be a colorable claim to the court that, no, they did get something. They got $5,000.
Right. Howard also lets Rebecca know to tell Jimmy that hey, before, you know, she takes over and, you know, totally liquidates the house, if he wants to stop by and, you know, find anything of any sentimental value he might want to keep, whatever, he's free to do so. Kim pretty much says, no, he's okay. He's not going to want to do that. And he also mentions that they're going to start a scholarship, a trust fund, you know, to help kids, you know, through law schools, if Jimmy wants to have a chair on that board or something like that. What follows after Rebecca leaves, Kim just rips into Howard. I was surprised by how much it emotionally affected me personally. I don't know how you two felt. I mean, I'm sure you both liked the scene, but I don't know. I was very it affected me very much emotionally, more so than anything from last week's episode, in fact. Like, I will even confess, I actually got teary during it, and I couldn't even tell you why, other than what she was saying. It wasn't just, you know, it making sense. It's showing how much, yeah, I don't know what. Are you on, Brian? Did they put you on the chain gang? Is that what happened? He's
definitely on the chain gang.
Definitely.
God. That's what happens when you contest a will without grounds. Apparently, you end up on the chain gang. And so does your advocate.
Or you get, you know, haunted by the ghost, Marley's ghost, or something, during the podcast. Well, it's one of the more unique sounds we've had. I was just really taken with her in that scene, and it's really, and, you know, and she has Howard back on his heels, and other than maybe the eventual climax of the entire episode, that to me was the strongest scene in the episode, and at least emotionally effective scene for me.
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say, I mean, for one thing, I was really impressed with Ray Seahorn's work here. Not that I like ever am not impressed with it, but it was really, I mean, you know, super high level stuff going on there. And then just, yeah, you're right. All the emotions that you can feel going through there, because I mean, you kind of gotta, you know, you kind of feel sorry for Howard, because, you know, Jimmy's kind of set him up into this position to just, like, you know, almost be the fall guy for this kind of thing. However, Howard also kind of did some douchey stuff when they were forcing Chuck out. And then you have, you know, Kim's in the position that, well, you know, Jimmy's basically kind of using her as some kind of, like, you know, to validate his, like, you know, attack on Howard type thing, as he's trying to, you know, use Howard to dodge his own blame. But, you know, just a lot of stuff going on there. It's like, you know, so much going on, so many different levels, it's hard for me to even say it out loud. Or it's hard for me to say anything out loud because I'm a fucking mealy-mouthed bastard. But, yeah.
I thought, even with the last episode, this was the most effective, because it made me think of... It made me rethink stuff. I heard you all discuss sort of the Jimmy-Howard interaction last week.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Kim reframed it, I found really powerful. You know, like, Jimmy kind of took it as an out, which in a way was sort of a blessing. So he sort of got something out of it, but she still turned it back on Howard.
Mm-hmm.
She even turned, like, the opportunity to go get some stuff if he wanted back on him in a way. I think I was moved because she really thought it through, and you really saw, like, the affection she had for Jimmy. Like, Jimmy does a lot of dumb stuff, but he wouldn't necessarily go do that methodically. And she methodically just destroyed Howard,
right?
And for him. And I thought it was very touching. Her emotion, I mean, she simmered and then exploded, and I thought it was just fantastic.
Right.
Yeah. And she was right, too. I mean, because, I mean, you know, that was one of the reasons Howard, you know, talked about that there. I mean, he felt guilty, and he was trying to reveal to people that, you know, I suppose he thought would be sympathetic to his cause, you know, having dealt with, like, you know, having they're dealing with Chuck, you know, kind of being a, you know, kind of not the easiest guy to get along with. So, I mean, you know, she's right. I don't know if I fault Howard exactly for his behavior in the last episode, because I don't really think that what he did was particularly out of line. He fucked up. He brought it up, you know, and of course he wants somebody to help him, you know, make it easier to sleep at night, but it's a complicated issue. And, you know, I don't think there's really any bad guys in this situation.
But can I add that the thing I thought was really different and why I think I love this show is it didn't set up Chuck's widow, who wasn't really his widow, as like a foil to her, like let's fight over stuff. She played like a nice part, and you can even see when Kim's getting mad and she said, well, it was nice to see you again. She stops for a second and is nice to her. As she leaves, I mean, it wasn't cliche, and I really think where I was most emotionally moved is when she took the letter and said, "Oh, what's this? One more screw you to Jimmy from Chuck Beyond the Grave," and to put him on the board of a scholarship, which Chuck in a million years would have never given Jimmy. Like, right. Those two, like last two hits, I think really just in that moment. Any doubt you would have about how strongly Kim feels for Jimmy, I think shows through. I think, you know, she loves him.
Right. And that carries over when we start the final act with the scene with Kim and Jimmy, when they have the funny little conversation about should they watch Jaws 3D or White Heat. And when they, but when they sit down on the couch together, she gives him a look, and that look, if one didn't get that she loves him the way she spoke in the previous scene with Howard, the look she gives him tells you all you need to know. And then she mounts him and everything else. But it's just, those two, and maybe it's because, you know, with, you know, fast forwarding the commercials in between, seeing those two scenes back to back, I initially, right there, I was writing down, you know, MVP of the episode, Kim. But then we have the rest of the episode to talk about, and now I'm 50-50 on that one. So we'll get there in a second.
And really, really nice work by Patrick Fabian again too. I mean, I was kind of raving about his just like voicemail last week, but I was really impressed by it. Just all the ranges of emotions going on his face there. I mean, it was really, really some good stuff.
I feel really good for the guy because he's one of those. Like journeyman character actors who, I mean, I don't even have to look him up on IMDb. I've seen him on a million things.
Longmire.
Well, that would be one of a million things.
Not the first necessarily either.
Yeah.
I was actually going to mention an episode of Lucifer, of all things. Anyway, all L words. But the point I was going to make is, like, you know, but he's been on a journeyman actor on, and shows, I mean, and some shows good, some shows not so good, and, you know, whatever. But I wouldn't say he ever, quote unquote, left his mark, at least in anything I've seen. I was like, oh, he's fine. You know, he's good, but, you know, whatever. I love that he gets a chance to really shine on this show. And as we've spoken since season one, quite frankly, how he's taken a part that, when it initially started, could have been just your, like what Brian was saying before, using the word cliche, could have been like one of the most cliche kind of characters ever. And he's done more with it. And he's made it just, he's given it enough little color or shading. And all, obviously, the stuff with Chuck has really brought it up far more so. And he's made him a much more interesting, much more fully realized character. Obviously it's a credit to the writers and everyone else, but it's the actor. And I'm glad that you see someone like that. He's been around a while. And it's nice to see him really getting to sink his teeth in something that he can be proud of. I'm sure he's proud of his work on both Longmire and Lucifer. But, yeah.
Well... His range in that scene is great because you really see him get reduced. And I think at the end, like you feel like sincerity when he says, what can I do? Like you see that she's reduced him. And I felt like he genuinely was saying, okay, I'm sorry, what can I do? And then she hits him with nothing. You know, it was a great scene. He let her play off of him well. He reacted to it well, mm-hmm. and there was nothing about that scene that was cliche. Right. And it was so good.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is not a show where anything cliche tends to happen, but this is one case where, I mean, I almost wish that, like, the cliche drama thing would happen where Howard somehow, like, you know, goes and, like, talks to the malpractice insurance people and finds out that, like, Jimmy, like, you know, totally freaking set him up there, and then, like, you know, some kind of, like, you know, antagonism happens, because I'm sure it'd be interesting to see. I mean, I'm definitely fine with the fact that they're not going to do the, you know, somewhat obvious route here, but you know, but same thing, you know, I'd like to see, like, you know, full on Howard rage here.
Well, I figured we got enough Howard rage in the final episode of last season, so I think maybe we'll be won't be so much rage, at least for the first part of this season. But also, I'm curious to see what the future interactions are going to be like. Because on one hand, if the estate's all squared away now, there might not be a reason for them to even interact with Howard anymore. I mean, I'm not saying they're going to. I have no idea. I have not looked. I mean, they could essentially write him off the show at this point, because there might not be a reason to have him on. I don't think they're going to do that. But it'll be interesting because of what she just said to him and his relationship with Jimmy as well. I'll be curious to see how they interact in future episodes. What will that be like? Will there still be a certain amount of awkwardness on Howard's part? Will he be able to compartmentalize the way Jimmy clearly can? You know, I'm curious about it. So it's one of the many questions we can have about a show that we thought we would never have questions about. So I like that.
Yeah.
Well, two quick thoughts. One, the attention to detail. And I was blown away by the shot when Kim went in the law office. Did you guys notice all the flags were at half mast?
Yes.
I thought, like, that's an incredible attention to detail to you know, get that, frame it. They shot it from above. And the other thought I had about Kim and Howard is, if, you know, Kim getting close to Jimmy and this sours her on Howard, I mean, it could be the start of Albuquerque's not a huge legal community. I mean, they could presumably go to war in the near future. And it could be, you know, Kim taking on a case against Howard and Jimmy maybe convincing Kim to cut a few steps to beat Howard because she's angry with him.
They could. I mean, to a certain extent, I'm not saying they won't do something like that. But on the other hand, that might be, to a certain extent, repeating some of the beats that happened with the whole Mesa Verde thing, because the whole thing when she was, you know, trying to get the clients, you know, from their firm and all. So we kind of already had them kind of going at loggerheads against each other to a certain extent already. Maybe not in the courtroom, but at least as far as getting and retaining a case or clients. So it could, of course it could happen, but we'll see. Or it might be more of a reluctant adversarial relationship where the last thing Howard wants to do is go up against him because of how he feels about everything that's happened. So it won't as opposed to before, where he had the clear, you know, he had his more what we thought at the time is his more natural vindictive nature, which turned out to not really be entirely accurate.
Right. Well, I agree with that, but my thought is this, and I'll probably be totally wrong, and I hope I am, but in the Mesa Verde thing, Jimmy tried to cheat without her active participation, where I could see it is because of how she perceived he did Jimmy. If she then takes an initiative and cuts a corner without Jimmy being involved and does it on her own and sort of does her own Breaking Bad because of her personal animus, I think that would be a little different and something maybe interesting and have really bad consequences.
Hmm. Well, if she did something like that, would she at some point then kind of blame her association with Jimmy as playing a part in what led her down that path then? Perhaps
it's a thought I have.
That doesn't really play with, like, that character though. I mean, because I don't see her, you know, not taking responsibility for her own actions or trying to, like, you know, blame it on somebody else necessarily.
Well, you got to look at it this way. the glasses we have to look through, as far as Kim is concerned, is a lot, especially for forecasting something happening down the road, always has to be tied into what's going to separate these two. Because the one, we don't know what it is, what happens, but we know it has to happen. So all we do is wonder what it is. And, you know, obviously the more he becomes, you know, quote unquote, you know, Saul Goodman-like, the more likely she's going to, you know, they're going to split apart. And we already saw her reactions before to when he did things that were, you know, not on the up and up as far as the law was concerned. You know, she had less of an issue with his, with the conning stuff when she even participated, as opposed to when he did stuff which was really, you know, the kind of stuff that resulted in him losing his license, quite frankly. Because that, that's where I don't, would she cross that line? I don't know. But she might, maybe at least to her own downfall. I don't know. It remains to be seen.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to take us down off track. Just to
we're
just
talking about the talking about the show. You know, we're not talking. You're not off track. Shut up. Anyway.
Yeah, it's fine. But yeah, I mean, we really don't know what's going to happen with Kim, since unlike Nacho, she never appears on Breaking Bad. We can't do anything but speculate.
But I did like when Joan Cusack appeared that time on Breaking Bad.
That
was awesome.
Oh man. Oh man! See that's what happens. I do a good deed and risk my life. I like him, and this is what I get. So
risk your life.
Yeah, I'm fighting to try to regain my position on the podcast. So I gotta take any. I have to take any openings you give me.
Well, I have two knives in me now. So
hashtag three way. Anyway, hashtag DP.
You know. We could call it the freeway three-way. So.
Oh, man. I hate that I didn't think of that myself. That's going to be the opening for next week's intro.
There you go.
The three-way to my freeway. Anyway, we've still got the remaining few minutes of this episode. So after a night of... I don't know if they ever got around to watching White Heat. I hope they did, because it's an excellent movie. But after a night of loving and sleeping, but Jimmy gets up in the middle of the night, and he goes online, and he's, like I said, he's looking at those Hummels. And Hummels are extremely collectible, especially if you have the right ones. He's seeing one that's going for like over $8,000. And next thing you know, he's making a little phone call. He's calling Mike, saying he has a job for him. Now... what that job might entail, because I can't see Mike being okay with going and robbing an old lady. But it's got to be something connected to that old lady in the Hummels, I'm assuming. So I'm kind of curious what that job is really going to be. I'm assuming we're going to find out next episode.
Doesn't he want him to just go to the Neff copier place and just rip off that Hummel that's there, since he identified it as being a valuable one?
Right, but I don't think he's going to go through all that trouble for one Hummel.
I don't know, if it's worth $9,000, maybe, I don't know.
And then what would Mike's cut of that be? Why would that, that doesn't seem to be the kind of money payoff that would be worth it. I think it's going to be something where it's got to be like, you know, it's got to be six figures. Or at least five figures for everybody.
Yeah, you could be right.
Well, I mean, you know, that sparks a thought in my head. Maybe that's why he turned the job down, so he wouldn't be accused of doing the inside job.
Right.
Maybe he wants Mike to recon the guy who, you know, runs the company, because he thinks he's a dunce.
Hmm. I didn't see if there was more than one Hummel figure there either.
I think there's just one.
Okay.
But if there's just one at your office, you might be a collector and you might have some at your house.
Yeah, and
that's a bit of an assumption. That's a bit of a stretch for an assumption to make.
Yeah, and that guy did, you know, he did say that, like, you know, this, just, you know, I got to get this junk out of here and just throw it away. I don't care about it. So maybe he figures he could just, you know, take it, and the guy wouldn't care enough to even notice.
Oh, by the way, spoiler, I watched the ad for the next episode, and Jimmy's mentioning something about it's $40,000 each. So, you know, it's got to be more than one Hummel figure. Just saying. Anyway, okay. So then we get towards the end of the episode, and we have this little showdown between Nacho and Ponytail Guy and Victor and Tyrus over the keys of, it's Coke, right? Because we're not in the meth business yet here. A little bit of a showdown. Obviously, it's pretty clear that Nacho's is the real badass here, and Ponytail Guy is kind of a schmuck. So it makes what ends up happening not the biggest surprise, except for one aspect of it. Because as they're leaving, obviously he gets the plastic bag over the head treatment.
He gets the plastic bag over his head, what's that look that Nacho gave his Ponytail Guy? Sadly, unnamed Ponytail Guy who is now deceased. He gives him just a really dirty glare. Do you guys have any, do you guys interpret that in any specific way? Because I wasn't sure if it was just like, you know, I want to get out of this business and you're putting me in this fucking this situation that I, you know, don't want to be in, escalating things, and here I am doing this thing, possibly.
I took it that way, exactly as you said, or, hey, Ponytail Guy, get off my podcast. It was one of those two. I took it as like, hey, I maintained the facade of being a badass, and now that we're outside, like, dude, what the hell? Like that over a key, we're going to start shooting people, and, you know, a lot of times the bad guy, the real bad guy, is the one that doesn't say anything, and the guy that causes everything is the one that runs his mouth. Yeah, he ran his mouth.
He was being a little douchebag, and I thought Nacho's look at him was like, why am I aligning myself with such a little douchebag? It's just, I don't even want to be doing this, and, you know, you run your mouth, and I gotta fucking clean it up for you.
To be fair, Balsa did say that he expected them to run the business the same way it was being ran, you know, with when Hector was involved. So, I mean, you know, if, you know, technically one would assume that he just thought that was, you know, his job to maintain that and be really risky if he just let the fring guys walk all over him.
So, I'm not questioning him demanding the other key. I just thought the way he went about it lacked a certain anything intimidating or interesting about it, you know,
it's a general rule that if your boss is dead or dying and you're one of the underlings, if you say to another crew, I'm the one calling the shots.
Exactly.
That's not a great move.
Yeah.
And that guy really ran his mouth, and, you know, he could have said, no, this is how we have to do it. Like I'm not walking out of here without that key. And, but he did it in a douche way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what was I saying? Oh, he gets the plastic bag over the head treatment. What I thought was interesting is that Gus does it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the box cutter episode in a certain episode of a certain show that almost everyone has seen, except for one or two people out there who've only seen Breaking Better Call Saul. But when he did that, I was like, oh, that's right. I forget. It's interesting how circumspect and almost anal retentively reserved Gus can seem so often. But he can have these moments of violent rage. And it took that to happen for me to remember, oh, yeah, I forgot he's capable of that. And then my mind went right to Box Cutter. It's like, oh, yeah, we've seen that before. I forgot about that, too. Oh, yeah. He does get his hands dirty. So then you have the end of the episode with him basically, although pretty much we all knew this because there was no way that was just a look, when he actually says to Nacho, who's, you know, kneeling on the ground, that he knows what he did, but the Salamancas, they do not. But from now on, you are mine. So now Nacho's basically switched teams, and he's working for perhaps a more sane. I don't know if sane's the right word for Gus. I'd say it is, but at the same time, maybe a more scary person. Really depends how you look at it. And that was the end of the episode. So, yeah, so go on.
No, I'm having a hard time With this Gus Fring character, I just don't see like a manager of a fast food chicken chain like with a murderous rage. Just doesn't seem really realistic to me.
Yeah, I bet. Yep.
Yeah, I saw that joke coming. Excellent. So. But Nacho's performance and the performance of Mando and what the character goes through this scene as well, and then you add that with the other scenes throughout the episode with his father or the hospital. So then I got torn as far as who I thought who was my little personal pick for MVP of the episode was. So I was going with Kim because I love that scene with Howard, but then I thought of all the work that Nacho did in this episode. So I was kind of torn between them. Do you guys have any preference as to which one comes out ahead there? Or do you just want to go off the reservation and pick, like, you know, Jimmy himself or something like that?
Yeah, I always kind of compartmentalize the show. So, you know, Kim is the MVP of the Better Call Saul half, and Nacho is the MVP of the Breaking Bad half, I guess.
I knew that. I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
No, I would give the slight edge to Kim. She took it up a notch. He took it down a notch. Like, he went from badass to, like, falling apart in a really good way.
Mm-hmm.
But the way she went at Howard, and I would give the slight edge to Kim. But, you know, two absolutely fantastic performances.
Oh, no, I wasn't mocking you. I really do view, like, you know, these as being, like, that's more of the Breaking Bad storyline. So I wish I was mocking you, but I was being serious there. So fuck you for thinking I was mocking you.
Jesus. Well, I think in the past, even if he didn't figure into what was going on with these situations, we kind of looked at whenever the show was focusing on stuff dealing with Jimmy, that's the Better Call Saul side. And when the show is dealing more with Mike, which therefore would lead to the cartel and Gus and all the other stuff, then that was more of the Breaking Bad side. Whether that's correct or not, who cares? I tend to see it that way a little bit myself. It depends on what's going on in the Jimmy storyline, quite frankly. The more it's about, like, Chuck and, you know, just the law firms and stuff like that, I think that way. When he starts to drifting into more seedier territory, which then makes him a bit more Saul Goodman-like then. Then I start thinking of it being kind of a more cohesive, not cohesive, actually, just more Breaking Bad-ish. Although this show, and we talked about it last week, and we talked about it in previous seasons, I think the show has really struck its own identity while still being a major part and overlapping the Breaking Bad universe. But I think it's really, it's doing its own thing now, so which is what's making it as good as it is, I think. So it's not just like a pale imitation kind of situation.
No, it's definitely its own thing. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's such a different experience. I saw an article, I believe there are people now who have started watching Better Call Saul that never watched Breaking Bad.
That sounds familiar.
Did you talk about that last week?
Yes.
Okay.
No, but talk about it. Go ahead. Shut up.
No, I saw something about it, and a comment made by someone in the article said that Better Call Saul, the episodes, if you have Netflix, you can watch them over and over the way some people do, in a way that Breaking Bad, it's harder to just do a, you know, watch an episode and replay it over and over again. So I think that it, you know, its tone and the way it is different. It struck its own identity in being the same thing character wise, but different in the way those characters are employed. And it's very, very, very good storytelling, but in a different palette, and these little touches of the story of what will become Breaking Bad have really added something to it.
I've said more times than I care to admit, you know, Breaking Bad is my favorite TV series at this point in time. So obviously, when I'm if I'm comparing a show to what's my favorite series, it's unlikely I'm going to say it's better.
Sure.
And I love Better Call Saul. But I was thinking about this, because there, I do think, although they obviously there's a lot of things they share together, and, you know, whether it be the personnel, you know, everything from the cinematographers, the writers, the directors, and as well as certain characters, and we know that this storyline is eventually making its way to meet that storyline. And there is something that got mentioned, apparently I didn't hear it, because I don't listen to any other podcast. I don't even listen to our podcast anymore, quite frankly. I even gave up doing that. But apparently there was something very interesting mentioned on an actually a good podcast about Better Call Saul, the Insider podcast last week that I wanted to mention here. But the point I wanted to make was, it's almost like they're both, it's almost like you have like two different works of types of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at Better Call Saul, it's more, you know, it's kind of like this really nice painting, like something that it could be something like, you know, water lilies or some sort of, you know, something by Matisse or whatever, you know, which, you know, it's beautiful to look at, and it certainly has substance to it, whatever. Whereas Breaking Bad, there's something just a bit, for me, still a bit more solid and maybe just more of an edge to it. So it's almost like, you know, like an amazing, you know, like an amazing sculpture by, like, whether it be a Picasso or a Michelangelo or whatever. Just, I mean, it's because Breaking Bad for me just has more weight to it. And that doesn't mean that Better Call Saul doesn't have weight to it. It's just, like, for me, Breaking Bad's a heavyweight, and Better Call Saul is, like, you know, a light middleweight or a welterweight. Even if it's a top, I mean, it's freaking Sugar Ray Leonard. We're talking a champion, but it's not Muhammad Ali. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
and I
yeah, but Better Call Saul doesn't always punch you in the face. Breaking Bad always had a darkness to it. Even most of the comedy was dark. And the feeling you had from the beginning of Breaking Bad is this guy's gonna die, right? Like, you know, it's cancer, like, and he's gonna just do crazy stuff because he doesn't care. And you knew with Breaking Bad early on that there's no way it doesn't have a tragic ending. Now, not that what happens to Jimmy becoming Saul isn't tragic, but it's just not on the same scale. I mean, becoming a scummy lawyer and what you lose, that can be a terrible story, but it's never going to end the way that the story of Walter White ended.
Right.
It just isn't. And so I see that there's a heft and a darkness that was always in Breaking Bad.
Right.
That this show sometimes, an episode will go by and there's some seediness or some creepiness, but there are episodes of Better Call Saul that don't have a real sinister part to them.
Right.
You know,
well, it's also, and also because on more often, especially as it went on, but you don't even have to get to the later seasons. There was an almost omnipresent feeling of life or death throughout most of Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm.
People's, and as it went on, and when it wasn't just one specific character, then you realize lives were on the line. You know, whether it be Walter, whether it be Jesse, whether it be their families or whomever. But that was the nature of what that show was. That's what that show was about. That's not necessarily what this show is about. It doesn't mean we do have storylines now when we get into the, and it's, again, as using what Dan was talking about, specifically on the Breaking Bad side of the show, where there is a potential for, as we saw tonight, you know, someone can be killed, people can be killed, you know, there is violence here, but it's still, that's kind of bleeding over from no pun intended with the word blood there, but from it's the breaking it's the Breaking Bad side of things. Whereas otherwise, it's really a story of, you know, a guy who he seems to try his best to be a good person, but he keeps slipping back into being kind of a not so good person. But there's a big difference between being a kind of a corrupt lawyer and being a murderous drug kingpin. So, you know, it's,
right.
they're on paths to, you know, a negative outcome. One is quite a bit worse than the other. It's worse to, there's a difference between being the mob lawyer and being the mobster.
Exactly. Exactly.
But if to give the Better Call Saul fans, you know, their due, in a lot of ways, Gilligan and Gould have a much harder job with Better Call Saul, because everything with Breaking Bad, everything was new, and they could just create as they went on. Better Call Saul begins, and they have certain restrictions in place. There's certain things you can't do. There's certain things that they're stuck with, because you can't change the continuity of, and we all know where these characters, anyone who's watched Breaking Bad, that is, knows where these characters are going to end up. So that kind of changes things, you know, because we all know it's going to end up happening to Mike. We all know it's going to end up happening to Jimmy / Saul. So their challenge was, okay, how do we get people to be interested in this more so? And I think we all give them credit is beyond the writing and this and that. It's like they've given us other characters to populate this universe that we care about. Kim being a big one. Nacho is becoming one of those characters for us. Even freaking Howard. Chuck was a great antagonist, although like, me and Dan talked about it for 3 seasons. We were never purely, totally anti-Chuck. Although that last season he started, it was probably the most anti-Chuck we'd ever gotten to. But because we were able to understand him. And maybe it's because, you know, Dan, I think you and I both have a history of other TV shows which will remain nameless, because I don't want to mention it, where there are characters that are traditionally not liked by other people, we tend to like.
Oh. Yeah. Hey, you told me not to name it, so I'm not gonna name it.
You can mention that there are other freaking shows. You could have went with Skyler there or something, dude.
I thought you were telling me not to bring up Star Trek, and I couldn't figure out how it would apply to this, so I didn't bring it up.
Oh my gosh. Oh, so just to get it, since I made a reference to it, let's just get it out there. What I heard that was said apparently or discussed on the Insider podcast, and I just feel I have to mention it because it opened my mind up to possibilities that I hadn't thought of. What they said was, there is no real, we've not told you, this is like speaking from the writer's perspective, Gilligan and Gould's perspective. I don't remember if it was them talking or Odenkirk himself talking, I think it was all of them talking. We don't know how far in the future that opening scene every season is with Gene. And what they were saying is like, it's very possible that those Gene scenes we're seeing, those little black and white scenes that open up every season, are at a time when Walter White's not dead yet. This isn't that much after, you know, it's still within that same, the fact that they were all openly discussing this, and I was like, huh, I never really thought about how far in the future, because there hasn't really been an indication. There was some wacky website that said that there was a year somewhere, which sounded ridiculous, because it's like 40 years in the future. It's like, no, he would be either be dead or he'd be a little wizened old man. That makes no sense. But, because I never thought about who he would be so fearful of his life from. Because we were going, would it be the Nazis? Would it be the cartel? And then the point that they were making on, I guess, on Insider Podcast, like, the person he's actually most frightened of is Walter White himself. And it may very well be the news that Walter White... Now, there's two different things that could happen, conceivably. The news that Walter White is dead might make him come out of hiding, so to speak. Or, if they want to figure out a way... They keep talking about how they do want to get Cranston on this show, but it has to make sense. It has to be a way where he just wouldn't, you know, randomly pass by and, you know, in a store, you know, years earlier or something. It's like, oh, I wonder if Walt could have passed by, you know, Nebraska on the way down to back to Mexico or something.
It is on the way.
So, and I never with all the talk about would they ever show up again, it never occurred to me. So I've been so focused on thinking of it, or I think we've all been focused on thinking of it as, you know, oh, years earlier, that'd be kind of silly. But if it's in the black black and white segment, and it's not technically, and he hasn't died yet, there is a way to do it, and that just struck me as very interesting. Again, who knows if they'll do anything like that at all? But it was a new theory I had never thought of, and I was almost slapping myself for not thinking about that, but. I guess I kept thinking that the Gene scenes, they felt like they were... I kept thinking of them being several years later.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, we'll find out eventually. But, yeah, he could either be afraid of Walt or it could be, you know, if it takes place after November 2016, you mean, yeah, he could be afraid of Nazis. I wouldn't blame him for that, so...
Oh... Well, then he's going to wish that he had been relocated to a Cinnabon in Canada or something at that point. Canadian said.
Yeah.
Canadian said.
It's okay. Any listener that would be offended by that that really lame joke I made already would have been so turned off by, like, the 2 minutes of Spanish language on the show by those really bad people that were here doing drugs that they would have stopped watching the show and wouldn't listen to the podcast anyways.
Well, you know, well, come on. The murderers, the rapists. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, I feel we've kind of wrapped this episode up. I think in a lot of ways, as much as I did enjoy the premiere, I think I like this better, one because we just got a little. It was kind of like a little smorgasbord. We got a little bit of everything in this episode, so we got a lot of moments for different characters to shine. I think almost every character actually did have a nice little moment here. Some bigger than others, obviously. You know. You know, either be Jimmy selling himself to the copier people, or Kim with Howard, or Howard with Kim. You know, either way, or Mike with Lydia, or Gus being, you know, horrifying, or the nachos. So it seems like a lot of people got, you know, their little moments throughout this episode. So I really enjoyed this one a lot.
Oh yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite episodes, maybe. In a while on the show, because it moved all the pieces on the board and gave us insights into a lot of, I mean, it's a pretty big reveal to see how Nacho gets with Gus, mm-hmm. You know, and who would have ever thought Kim would be deeply in love with Jimmy? There was always a weirdness to their relationship that it worked, but it, you know, I thought this was an excellent episode. A plus.
Yeah, I thought the premiere was great, but it was, you know, it was a lot more, you know, characters in shock and all sorts of stuff going on, and there was a lot more you know, aggressive, cool anger stuff going on this one that it worked for me a lot. Plus the fact that, like, now we can look forward to the possibility of maybe Michael, like, try to break into 7 more magical facilities that are looking for him and, like, find creative ways to mess with him, and I would like to see that a lot because it would be funny.
You know what they should do, just to save time on the show. Just they should then put up on the AMC website just a series of webisodes of Mike going to each magical facility, and hopefully there's an equally silly conversation like the Bruce Lee Muhammad Ali one at every single one. You know, it's like, you know, like Superman versus Mighty Mouse or whatever, you know, stuff like that.
And at some point, there has to be an employee break room with an employee of the month picture of Mike in deadpan at Madrigal. Like, just completely deadpanned. Look at the camera.
I just like the idea of Mike just photobombing, you know, different office birthday parties and stuff like that.
Just signing random birthday cards and
karaoke. Anyway. Sorry, I got it on my brain tonight. Okay. Is there anything else you guys wanted to talk about before I wrap it up?
Is there?
I'm asking you.
Since we like to talk about Billy Wilder movies on the Serious TV Drama Podcast, last night I watched the film Witness for the Prosecution for the first time. So I was just wondering, what you guys have to say about it, since it is a courtroom drama, and this TV show is relevant to that. And this TV show referenced another Billy Wilder movie.
Did it?
Double Indemnity.
Yeah, the one Demi's thing. Okay, yeah. But then, why he's not Billy Wilder?
I'm not sure. Brian, have you seen it?
I have. It's an excellent movie. I have a problem with courtroom stuff because courtroom stuff is dramatized in a way that it's not, not realistic in any sense of the word. But it's an excellent film. And sort of is the template for a lot, spoiler alert, if you're the douchebag who hasn't watched it and are going to complain, that 60 years later, that we're going to talk about it. But the sort of idea of the lawyer who believes in the client and the client dupes the lawyer, that mm-hmm. sort of, trope.
Yep.
But it's really great. And you know what's interesting, in about this movie, and I was just looking at the cast notes when Dan mentioned maybe wanted to talk about it. The premise is Charles Lawton's character, is sort of ailing and not maybe needs to quit the practice of law. The interesting thing is, I didn't know this, is that Tyrone Power actually, this was the last movie he completed. Mm-hmm. And he filmed another movie but didn't finish filming and died mm-hmm. before finishing his next movie.
Yep.
Which I thought was kind of crazy based on the premise of this movie, that the lawyer's the one in ill health. And but really, a series of twists and turns. Of course, the thing that works for the movie but is insane is no person in the courtroom is going to get a hold of evidence and stab somebody to death, but what are you going to do? It's an excellent movie, well done, great acting. Enjoy it, and somebody watching it now would probably go, oh, I saw that twist and turn come, but back then, I'm sure that it was probably pretty shocking.
Well, they probably wouldn't say it after listening to the podcast, but no, I'm just kidding.
Well,
no, but I didn't really. I was just kind of watching, and I guess that I've seen some courtroom stuff from that thing. I'm not as bothered by it as you are, being so close to it, Brian. Even though the Los Pollos Hermanos stuff on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul can get me a little freaked out sometimes, because that is not how you cook chicken, fuckers. But no, I thought it was a really good movie. But I really wasn't expecting for the last 10 minutes of just crazy craziness happening. I just thought, maybe there'd be a little something and whatever. But I kind of felt it was wrapped up before that point until I realized the clock had a little ways to go. So I I'm not surprised, but I didn't really see it. I didn't expect that to happen.
It's one of those movies that if you look and see how much time's left, then you go, oh crap. Here something is going to happen. If you're in the moment and just watch it, it probably is pretty surprising. But if you're one of those people that has to click and see and goes, hey, how much is left? Oh, there's still 15 minutes left and it seems over. Then, here comes some hijinks. So,
I've always been a big fan of the movie. I'm a fan of the story to begin with. It's Agatha Christie. And I grew up being, due to my mother, I was a big fan of Agatha Christie stories. So that's so you're already starting with a great foundation. It's Agatha freaking Christie. And then you got Billy Wilder doing it, and you put together this marvelous cast. Charles Laughton, you know, who... Charles Laughton is just... He's a fascinating guy to begin with. I mean, you know, I mean, the man directed Night of the Hunter. If he did nothing else but that, he deserves his right to immortality. And the fact he's done some marvelous acting throughout his career, including this movie, is fabulous. I don't want to get... I wouldn't... Obviously, unlike our guest podcaster here, I am not in the legal profession. I also would caution the fact that we are dealing with the court systems of England, not the U.S., so there are, I mean, obviously the stuff with someone grabbing a knife and all that other stuff, that's, yeah, obviously, duh. But as far as the way they go about things and a certain theatrical nature of the way they go about things in Britain, kind of has, I mean, obviously it's played up more because we're watching a work of fiction, but just in general, that is their, they do tend to be that way. I mean, they're still wearing the wigs, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And they have to go, and there's all this pomp, you know, that's kind of a, and there has been people who are screaming on the stand, whatever, in like actual cases and all that kind of crazy crap.
I mean, it's not insane. It's just one of those things that, you know, knowing how it works, it's a minor pet peeve.
I will make a recommendation for people and you, perhaps, if you haven't seen it yourself, if you can track this down. I believe, 2 weeks in a row, we're going to reference an almost ancient podcast of ours, Dad. I can't believe this. I think I did this. I think when we did a podcast when we were covering TV shows from our favorite picks from the six and recommendations from the 60s and 70s, if I'm not mistaken, one of my more arcane picks, as opposed to the obvious ones from the 70s, I believe I picked a show that had been shown on PBS. I think it was part of Masterpiece Theater before there even was a mystery program on it. Called Rumpole of the Bailey, which starred Leo McKern, who people would know from things like The Prisoner and the movie Help with the Beatles and such. If you want to watch something which feels really, really, really real, and it's about the British court system, and I will tell you right now, is my firm belief that although they're based on these books by, I think the writer is John Mortimer, I'm fairly certain Witness for the Prosecution had some impact on that writer and had some influence on him, because he would then writing about this aging, should retire already barrister who likes his little, who likes to have a little drink here and there and is constantly being bothered by the woman of the house and whatever. So there are some interesting similarities, and Leo McKern also fills up the screen and is as vivid a character as what Charles Laughton does in Witness for the Prosecution. So for folks, if you guys are able to decide to track down Witness for the Prosecution, if you haven't seen it already and you want to watch it, and by all means, it's one of many Billy Wilder films that are worth seeing. But if you start wanting to watch anything else fictional that deals with the British court system, I would recommend that. I actually own them on DVD. I don't know where you'd find it now. I'm sure it's streaming somewhere. You could probably find episodes of it on YouTube for all I know. But Rumpole of the Bailey is really worth watching. And it's, especially if you really want something that really feels real and doesn't make anything look very pretty either. So it's a very good show.
Well, I'll make an observation. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dan.
I just, even though I've been tearing through old movies for a couple of years now, this is the first time I've seen Charles Laughton, Tyrone Power, or Marlene Dietrich in anything.
Wow. Okay.
It's a pretty powerful trio.
Marlene Dietrich? You didn't watch Touch of Evil in the last year or two?
I did. I just don't remember her in it. I mean, I don't remember who, I guess. Oh yeah, maybe I saw her in it, but I don't remember who she played.
I think she's got the last line of the movie.
I guess she wasn't. I didn't remember it, but
okay. So you're watching too many. Anyway, go on, go on.
No, I was just going to say, the one thing I love about this movie that is true, and is I love the idea of the wife creating the illusion that she was disillusioned, because people just don't believe you if you're the spouse and provide an alibi. That's even true today. I mean, if your family gives you an alibi, but somebody else says they saw you, jurors don't tend to believe that. I mean, there's a beautiful subterfuge to that of, it would be better if I attack him and then I'm discredited for him. There's a weird math to that actually works out. So I love that part. And then the last thing I was going to ask was, because I don't know this, is having read the Agatha Christie story, how would you rate the conversion of that to a film? Was it pretty accurate, pretty good adaptation?
I would say it was a mostly faithful adaptation. I mean, there are some differences. That always happens with especially with Agatha Christie stuff. But it's a great story. Obviously, the funny thing is, and I think I mentioned this online. Maybe when Dan was talking about Witness for the Prosecution on Facebook days earlier. I mean, again, I mentioned before, big Agatha Christie fan. You know, obviously with all the Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple stories, whatever. But the funny thing is, two of my all-time favorite old, quote-unquote, old movies are both based on Agatha Christie stories that are not based around one of her famous running detectives. Witness for the Prosecution is one of them, and the best version of And Then There Were None, which I think is from 1945, I want to say, is the other one. And both are really good adaptations, but they do make some changes, but it works for the movie. There's nothing that one would get too caught up. And Then There Were None, some people might get caught up that they changed the ending, because the ending of And Then There Were None is really dark. and they don't go quite that far in the movie. Witness for the Prosecution, it's probably a bit closer an adaptation, at least as far as how the resolution works out. But plus it's Billy Wilder, you know, so it's gonna be good.
Right.
I didn't look who did he was he the sole writer credit on that? Or did he co-write it with somebody? I've never actually thought of
looking at it. He co-wrote it with somebody. I don't remember who.
Oh, I'm dying to know this.
Yeah, he usually has a co-writer.
Well, the funny thing is that he was horrible to work with. So writers who worked with him couldn't loved the final product was always amazing, but he was just such a huge pain in the ass to work with. I think it was like Raymond Chandler was like, oh, I'm gonna kill him. Let me see, Billy Wilder and Harry Kernitz, he wrote Shadow of the Thin Man. He wrote a whole bunch of things. Okay.
Rabbit hole alert.
Yeah, I know. And plus, we're on a podcast. I should stop doing that. Anyway, okay. So, think of that as we should, you know what we should do? At the end of every stupid podcast, we should bring up some other legal movie and talk about it for a few minutes. Of course, they're all going to be obvious ones. Like, oh, gee, 12 Angry Men. Really good movie there, guys. No, anyway. So, I'm going to wrap this up because we're just about the same length as we were last week, which I didn't think was going to happen 2 weeks in a row. So, if you enjoyed this podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. So, like the page and join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul and so many others. You can track us down on iTunes. Type in the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Where you can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. And as I keep saying now, you can just type us into Google and you'll find us. God knows where else you can find us. And you can also follow us on Twitter, although we seem to not tweet very much, and that's my bad. But our handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. I keep forgetting, I've been forgetting for 4 years now, that we actually have an email address that we've never used. Not that it matters at this point anyway. And I thought about it the other day, and here's the problem. I didn't know the password to get it. It's under your fucking curse. Damn it.
I got an email saying like somebody was trying to get into the account, and it's like, okay.
It was me because I thought I just assumed it was under. I mean, I'm just glad that I'm just because I got scared there for a second. Then I realized, oh wait, it's a different Gmail account I use for all the inappropriate emails that I used to get. So, at least I hope so. Anyway, on that oddly creepy note, Brian, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it was fun.
Did you pull over at some point? Because it sounded like the driving stopped at a certain point.
Yeah, I actually am sitting in the parking lot of the motel.
And the chains? What were the chains? You didn't Yeah.
Well, he put her back in the trunk, so we didn't hear the chains anymore. Oh wait, that's you. I'm thinking everyone's a killer. Hey Brian, have you watched Goliath yet? By the way.
I haven't watched season 2 yet, but it's on the next couple of shows I want to watch. One of my best friends, who we watched season 1 and talked about, told me the other day that I should check out season 2. So it's coming up soon.
Okay. But you like season 1 though, right?
Yeah, I did. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, it's really good. Okay. I don't know why I'm bringing that up when I'm trying to wrap up the podcast. All right. Anyway, Brian... Thanks for joining us. Thanks for pushing Dan just that one little bit further out the door of the spot.
Anytime.
I appreciate it. I have things to do.
Places to go, people to kill. All right.
Something like that.
All right. So, good night, Dan. Good night, Brian. Good night, everybody out there.
Good night.
Good night.